criminal charges for not acting during the Stoneman Douglas shooting, how schools are reporting discipline problems, and U.S. cruise ships are banned again from Cuba. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Scott Peterson, the school resource officer at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, was charged this week for failing to act during the school shooting. And one member of the state commission investigating the shooting thinks he should face more charges.
We know for sure that the deaths on the third floor could have been completely preventable had he gone into that building.
Also this week, the debate over if a discipline program for students is a diversion program. And 3 years after cruise ships were allowed to sail to Cuba from the United States, that stopped this week under the Trump administration. Your phone calls and texts coming up on the South Florida Roundup, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. This week, former Broward County Sheriff's Deputy Scott Peterson was arrested on criminal charges. Those charges include child neglect, culpable negligence, and perjury. He was the school resource officer on duty at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School on February 14, 2018. Peterson was widely criticized for not confronting the shooter last year at the school. Max Schachter is on the state commission investigating the shooting. He lost his son, Alex, in the tragedy.
I never thought that he would be charged, so I'm extremely happy. He could have gone in that building. He couldn't have saved my little boy. My Alex was already gone by the time he arrived. But I know that if he had gone in, he could have saved those six people that died on the third floor and the four kids that were shot and injured.
Peterson's arrest this week was the result of the state investigation by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. That agency has been looking into how law enforcement officers responded during and after the shooting. I spoke earlier this week with Broward State Senator Lauren Book about Peterson's arrest and how it raises other concerns, like potential criminal charges for teachers who elect to carry firearms in the classroom. Senator Book, welcome back to the South Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time today. Do you agree with the charges filed this week against Scott Peterson?
I do, and I wish that we could have gone further. Listen,
such as what, more charges?
I wish that we could. I wish that nonfeasance, misfeasance, and malfeasance doesn't fit anyone more perfectly than this coward of Broward. This is an individual who didn't move for 48 minutes, provided misinformation for responding officers, which made the response even more complicated and complex. And really, from the get-go, has stonewalled and not given information that he should have. And it has really been a source of pain and grief for this community. And so
let's talk specifics here. He faces 7 counts of neglect of a child, 3 counts of culpable negligence, and 1 count of perjury. What other accusations would you support filing against him?
Well, I think that we know for sure that the deaths on the third floor could have been completely preventable had he gone into that building. You know, some of those deaths when the shooter first got into that building weren't necessarily preventable. But we know when he was dropped off by Andrew Medina at the front door of the 1200 building, he could have gone into that building. And that was at a point in time where he wasn't even down the hallway.
So would you support some kind of involuntary manslaughter type charge?
Yeah, and at least one for every count of a child who was shot and or killed. I think that this is an individual where we need to make an example of him. And I'm just glad that we were able to, that this is kind of where we are, even though it's not as far as maybe I would have wanted or some others would have wanted.
These are certainly serious charges against Scott Peterson. What you are talking about, even more serious criminal charges, involuntary manslaughter, for instance. What are any of these charges that he has been accused of officially, charges you'd like to see leveled against him? What does that mean as school districts look at allowing teachers to be armed?
You know, look, I think that this is an individual who was a law enforcement officer, sworn to serve and protect and make sure that the kids and individuals that he was sworn to protect, that he would do so. And he did exactly the opposite. He protected himself. He provided misinformation and did nothing to prevent loss of life. And so, you know, I think that as we look at, and the legislature kind of moved along a piece of legislation in 7030, to arm educational personnel. I think this is something that we need to be paying attention to.
7030 is the number of legislation, the bill number of the new law that allows for arming of teachers in Florida.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So finish that thought here. As the legislature moves forward regarding that effort, and you've seen a number of districts move forward, certainly there's training involved before teachers carry firearms in schools and whatnot. But what do the charges against Peterson tell you, inform you as a legislator about the potential, the what ifs, should an instance, a tragedy like this or even less than this present itself with a teacher and a firearm?
Look, I think that we need to look at, and this is a local control issue. That's what the bill 7030 that you talked about is set to do. If a local school district chooses to allow educational personnel to carry a firearm, they are able to do so. And I think that when you look at the training and the different components that they seek to put in place, they need to have that outlined. Look, we saw that with, it's an issue that I can't really speak to because of some of the issues that will come before the legislature in terms of former Sheriff Scott Israel. Mm-hmm. But what does the training look like? What are the words in those training manuals? And what is the legal precedence for this? And I think we're all in really unchartered waters here and really need to be paying attention.
So I suppose the blunt question now is, if a teacher is armed and has gone through all the appropriate training as the legislature has laid out in this legislation, in this law, and an instance presents itself and the teacher does not take action, does that perhaps lead to the possibility of prosecution for the inaction of a legally armed teacher?
You know, again, I think that we don't know that yet. I think that that the training that they go into talks about if there is a active assailant situation that you can engage. And a lot of the conversation and dialogue is, what if you're in a classroom? Let's say you're in a math class of second graders. Are you supposed to lock your classroom door, leave your second graders and go and engage a shooter? I don't know that that's the safest thing to do. And I think that these are case by case basis. And again, I think we're in uncharted waters here. And we do need to be looking at this. But I think the case is different with a law enforcement officer who's charged and whose duty is to protect and serve the community. That is not necessarily what a school teacher is, what their duties are necessarily. And I think we do have to look at what this means and be paying attention as we go into the next legislative session and see and look at what do the training materials say and dictate.
It was disclosed this week to the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Commission that almost 200 schools in the state are not in compliance with the law passed after the attack, which requires each school to have armed security. How many of those are in South Florida, Senator?
There are several. And I think that this is, again, one of those things that is a sore spot and a source of contention for those of us on the commission. It's maddening to think about sort of where we are. Everybody will agree, whether it's, you know, putting the armed educational personnel aside, all parents want their kids to be safe at schools and they want them to be sworn law enforcement officers. Unfortunately, we don't necessarily have all of the law enforcement capabilities out there because we simply don't have the law enforcement officers to fill the void.
So when you talk about several schools in South Florida out of compliance, first, can you give us a sense of the types of schools? Are these charter schools entirely, somewhat? Do they include traditional public schools as well?
They do include traditional public schools as well, some elementary schools, middle schools, and high schools. It goes across the board. I think that we have found time and time again different situations where districts are choosing to enforce things that they want to enforce. And as communities and as parents, where we have kids in schools, we need to be holding those districts accountable.
Let's talk about accountability here, because the Department of Education has this week decided to give schools until August 1st to become compliant with this armed security regulation or be publicly named. August 1st would give parents, teachers, and communities maybe a couple of weeks before the start of the next school year to know whether or not the school that's in their neighborhood or their child or grandchild or niece or nephew is going to is in compliance. Why August 1st? Do you support that date, or would you like those schools to be named now?
You know, I think that is trying to give, again, give these districts the benefit of the doubt. Look, I've said time and time again, we've given them plenty of time. We shouldn't have to chase them for information that they should already be providing, like the CSER data, whether or not they're complying with the laws that we have outlined for them.
So would you like to name these schools now?
I think that that's an important piece so that parents can understand what's going on during these summer months, where we can take, you know, some action to get them to a place where we feel comfortable as parents and community members that the school that their children are going to are safe. But this is, you know, the date and time that August 1st, that we have some time to kind of get people to where they're needing to be.
You are just back from Israel. You accompanied Governor Ron DeSantis on the trip to Israel. Part of your focus was looking at school security. As a legislator, as a regulator, what did you see in Israel that you can import back into Florida that could find its way into future legislation?
One of the things I think that we took away was how there is no siloed communication, whether it's, you know, a co-located welfare, education, criminal kind of component, law enforcement, all in one place, or everyone communicating about students. The state is broken up into regions there, in six different regions. And there is a psychiatrist, not just a psychologist, but a psychiatrist in charge of each region. And if there is a child where there is some concern, that child is referred to that psychiatrist. There's a plan put in place, and that psychiatrist is in charge of ensuring that that child gets the things that they need and the educational plan that they have to have.
Speaking with Broward County State Senator Democrat Lauren Book earlier this week, what are your thoughts on the arrest and charges against Scott Peterson? We'll take your phone calls and texts coming up. The voice line, 800-743-WLRN. Again, the voice line, 800-743-9576. You could send us a text. Just be sure to include where you're texting from and your first name. That would be helpful for us as well. The text line is 786-786-7636. Again, the text line, 786-786-7636. Still to come on the program, the State Commission investigating the shooting, debating the efforts to improve Broward's 911 communication system. That's all ahead. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. The Marjory Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission met for 2 days this week in Sunrise. We covered a lot of ground during those 2 days. One topic concerned how schools report behavioral incidents like school fights. The process is not consistent across the state. Commissioners talked about ways to improve the process. Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtari chairs the commission.
I think the looming question that's raised time and again is whether the non-reporting and under-reporting is intentional to conceal what is really happening on school campuses across Florida, or whether there's another reason for the misreporting, such as flaws in the system.
That's Bob Gualtieri, the Pinellas County Sheriff, who chairs the Marjory Stoneman Douglas Safety Commission. Another major topic focused on Broward County's emergency communication system. It faced criticism after the shootings at the Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport and after the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School shooting. The county is now upgrading its radio communications. So what's been your experience dialing 911 in Broward County, for instance? What do you think about school safety as this school year comes to an end this week across South Florida? Have you seen a fight at school? What happened? Share your experiences. 800-743-WLRN is our voice line, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text. Be sure to include your name and where you're texting from to this number, 786-786-7636. Again, 786-786-7636 for our text line. Katie Swatowski is with us here in studio. She covers all things Broward County for us at WLRN. You were at these meetings this week, Katie. It was 2 long days of meetings, which is pretty standard protocol for this commission. Scott Peterson certainly was the focus of the news surrounding the meeting, but not necessarily in with the meeting agenda. The other important items, as we mentioned, first, let's tackle this idea of the behavioral incidents. How did this come about for the commission? What was the focus of the conversation?
So ever since the commission started meeting, they have been doing witness interviews and trying to figure out how schools keep track of incidents, whether it's a school fight, whether it's something more serious, like someone is concerned about another student and they think that they pose a threat. And the idea is that in doing all of these different school interviews, they do not find any schools do them consistently or keep track of them consistently or have a team in place called a threat assessment team.
Are there guidelines for the schools to follow that they aren't following, or is it at
now
a local level?
Now there are, but before it was really varied and schools could pick and choose how they wanted to handle these incidents, who reported the incidents, where they would go in the administration system, how they were handled in general. And if and, you know, the commission found that a lot of schools were underreporting, a lot of schools were overreporting, a lot of schools were, not following protocols or policies that they had.
What kind of incidents are we talking about here that would normally get captured with this reporting or that the commission thinks should get captured by the reporting?
So I'll use a school fight example, an altercation where two students are physically beating each other up, someone gets injured, someone has, potential criminal charges that could be brought against them, or
assault
they need to
or
go
something like that, for instance.
Yeah, physical altercations, or someone has to go to the nurse. They're bleeding. There's hurt. It's not for, you know, two kids that have a verbal fight and someone's feelings get hurt, but it's got to be more serious than that.
And why is the reporting of these incidents important to the commission?
So, what they're looking at, is, especially with threat assessments, in the case of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School shooting, there was multiple people that came forward to the school and said, hey, we're concerned about who is the confessed Parkland shooter. And where that threat went through the school system was not handled correctly, the commission found. And so whether it's their commission's trying to look at all schools across Florida now and say, okay, well, where are threats? Where are school fights? Where do we need to improve having more school safety? Mm-hmm. And that's the encompass. It's called CSER reporting. Mm-hmm. And so they're looking at how schools keep track of whether it's threats or any kind of behavioral or safety issue. And they found that schools were, you know, either not keeping track or classifying. Everyone has different definitions of what a fight is.
Right.
Everyone's got different definitions of what a physical altercation is.
Right.
So it was not anywhere similar across the board.
And so there's questions around the reporting of the data. And then what happens to the student who may be involved in those kinds of things, programs that he or she may be geared towards? Some of those could be in the criminal justice realm of things, for instance.
Correct.
Referred to prosecutors. Other times, as we saw with the confessed shooter in Marjory Stoneman, referred to what has been called a diversionary program or some other kind of behavioral adjustment type of program or alternative school setting.
Correct. So we've talked about the Promise program a lot on this program. And I will remind you, it's just Broward County's diversionary program. And that is for a student that commits a crime or, you know, let's say they punch another student. And it's a way for them to avoid having a criminal record, the school to prison pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
But the commission was actually talking a lot about these diversion programs today or this week at their meetings because they're looking at how schools follow diversion protocol that the commission has set forth. You know, diversion programs are for criminal charges only. Well, previously in Broward County, it could be for behavioral issues as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so the definitions of, you know, are we reporting someone who's in a school fight? Do they get referred to Promise? Do they get put in the CSER reporting? Does it go up a threat assessment? There's a gray area about how all of that is handled.
And this was really under scrutiny by the commission this week as it relates specifically to Broward County Public Schools in terms of the Promise program about whether or not it is still being
technically a diversion
program. Operated as a diversion program or not.
And the commission absolutely argued to the State Department of Education that it is a diversion program because it's taking a student that could potentially face criminal charges for theft or something, for a misdemeanor, and puts them through a program to avoid that. That is what a diversion program is for. And so Broward County was arguing, oh, you know, we're not sure if Promise is a diversion program anymore. They tried to change the definition of Promise, and the commission came out and said this week, no, it is absolutely considered by us to be a diversion program.
Talking with Katie Swatowski, our reporter here at WLRN who covers Broward County. She covered 2 days of meetings by the Marjory Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission this week, talking about a number of items continuing around the aftermath of that tragedy in Broward County in February of 2018. 800-743-9576 is the phone number. That's our voice line. Again, 800-743-WLRN. Or you can send us a text at 786-786-7636. 786-786-7636. During the first day of the commission meeting this week, it was announced that the Florida Department of Law Enforcement was bringing charges against Scott Peterson, the school resource officer who was on duty at Marjory Stoneman Douglas on February 14th of 2018, a series of criminal charges leveled against former Deputy Peterson. Your thoughts on that? Amanda on line three is joining us from Miami. Go ahead, Amanda. You're on the radio.
Hi. So I am a public school teacher in Miami, and I love the idea of having a resource officer at our school, and we do have one. However, he sits in his car at the side of the school all day. And so my question is, why can't we have these police officers coming into the school and being proactive and teaching our students gun safety and gun violence?
It's a great question, Amanda, and thanks for your service in the classroom, by the way. Enjoy summer break. Katie, what about this conversation about the duties of school resource officers, certainly back in focus with these charges against former Deputy Peterson?
Absolutely. It's something that the commission has talked a lot about. What are the guidelines? What are school resource officers or school safety officers or armed guardians? What are they supposed to do? And there's not a whole lot on that. It's something that they're working on. They have some guidelines, but certainly, you know, sitting in a car all day is not what the commission has in mind.
And also different kind of levels of deputization, right? I mean, some school districts like Miami-Dade School District has its own police force. Other school districts don't have their own deputized police force, so they kind of contract out with other law enforcement agencies. And others, again, use school resource officers, as was on display at Marjory Stoneman.
And that's what the commission runs into, because they're trying to make recommendations for every school district and every school in the state of Florida. But like you mentioned, the resources available to each district are very, very different. So what's okay for one district that's smaller to do that it wouldn't be okay for a bigger district to do? And so in looking at especially the schools, as Senator Book mentioned, that are not in compliance with the laws, mm-hmm. still, that was a big topic of conversation this week, and figuring out how those schools are going to get into compliance and why they have not been in compliance for more than a year now, more than a year and 3 months, yeah. is very much a topic of discussion for them.
Lisa in Miami Gardens on line two. Thanks for your patience, Lisa. You're on the radio.
Hi, good afternoon. I've worked in the school system, and my concern is that while the incident is very tragic and people lost their loved ones, I feel like the national media, especially the local media, and a lot of politicians are fanning the flames against Scott Peterson. Okay, no one wants to pay for services that are really needed for a lot of these kids. We send them to outside sources who are supposed to provide mental health services, and they really don't. All they do is bill the insurance. Okay, and nobody wants to address that. Nobody wants to address the fact of the kind of training that they give some police officers. The training is so outdated, okay? And a lot of this training came after September 11th, and it was not updated because they are told to control the perimeter of the building. They're told not to go inside. We're going to bring SWAT. And it takes time to do all of that.
Yeah, Lisa, I appreciate your constructive criticism there, and let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, one thing on the training side, the training that former Deputy Peterson received regarding active shooting was specified. It's laid out in the charges as kind of rationale, according to the prosecutors, of why they're bringing these charges now.
But but Peterson's lawyer is arguing, look, we are using Peterson as a scapegoat.
Right.
And so obviously that's not the opinion of this commission, but that is the argument that Peterson's attorney is making. And the active assailant training that he had from the Broward County Sheriff's Office on the day of the shooting did not say that he had to enter a building,
that's
or
right.
that he shall enter a building. It said he may.
Right.
And so that is a potential, for differences in training. It's not that way anymore. What standard will he be held to?
The charges against Peterson also have brought up, have renewed the conversation around other
layers of law enforcement. For instance, the FBI and the FBI tip line that received some tips for the eventual confessed Parkland shooter, and how those tips were not followed up on. Had that, as these, as the announcement of the charges against Peterson were made public this week with the commission meeting, did those other kind of layers of accountability or inaction, was that brought up?
It was, but the commission's not sure yet exactly how that's going to play out. And so the charges brought against Peterson were done based on an FDLE investigation. Mm-hmm. Well, FDLE also runs and operates the commission. And so that's why the news was announced this week. But when you talked to commissioners, especially the commission's chair, Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri, you know, the question of, okay, there was another sergeant, Sergeant Brian Miller, who was fired this week for inaction. Are criminal charges going to be brought against him? And at that most simple question, FDLE and the commission could not answer that yet. Mm. They said, we don't know. We don't, you know, we're not sure. It's possible, but there's no definitive.
Lots of hours also were spent this week by the commission talking about communications by law enforcement and
yes.
the Broward communication system, 911, police radios. This is a it certainly is heightened by the Stoneman Douglas tragedy. We saw the consequences of this during the Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International shooting back in January of 2017. Thank you. What was the nature of the discussion regarding the Broward emergency communication system?
It's, you know, updates are coming. The county purchased updates, but the updates were supposed to be here, you know, May. They're more than a year late. If there are no more delays, which there already are, the system upgrades are delayed for another year and a half. And that was with the commission assuming that this last one radio tower in the city of Hollywood would go up without a hitch, no litigation. And that is not what happened this
right.
week.
There was some movement on that separate from the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Commission.
Absolutely.
Where the Hollywood City Commission took a vote.
But
a unanimous decision that they don't want the radio tower.
Well, so
where they were
it was about
locate.
It was a site approval plan.
Okay.
So the county had a couple weeks ago voted to remove all the deed restrictions from Westlake Park in Hollywood. And they're like, okay, we're going to move forward with this. We've removed the deed restrictions. They submitted site approval to the city of Hollywood, and the city of Hollywood said that it, you know, these plans don't meet their zoning. So now there's a back and forth. There was a meeting between the county and city officials yesterday, and it just causes more delays. The commission, the state commission, you know, investigating the shooting, is really moved out of its investigation role and into mitigation role, I like to think of it as.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that because now they're just trying to put out fires and help regulate the school safety. This is something they're very upset about.
On the communication side, because obviously it affects way beyond
school safety. It affects the entire county
right.
for radio police.
It's public safety.
Yes.
It's fire, it's police, it's emergency. And so where does the accountability lie in this, Katie? And what's the timeline? What should the citizens, the residents of Broward County expect when it comes to, you know, the communication system as we're between the month of June and the end of November?
So That's different depending on who you ask.
Yeah.
But one thing we know for sure is it's going to depend on litigation. And so the residents that have fought against this tower going up in Westlake Park for environmental reasons, for property concerns, they don't want to lose part of their park.
Mm-hmm.
So they can litigate against the city if the city approves this. The county can litigate against the city for delaying the entire upgrade to the system. But I will tell you, as recently as last week on June 1st, that Saturday, there were issues with the radio system. It did not go down as the MSD commission had said it did, but there were less channels available for dispatchers to reach police officers for about an hour.
So the capacity of it was...
Capacity is the biggest problem with our current radio system right now. That's something that the upgrade is supposed to completely fix. There's a lot more capacity. There's a lot more mm-hmm. of just technology available. But to do that, they need to put up this last tower. There's one going up right now in Parkland. There's one going up in Tamarack. Tamarack was also a little resistant. But now that's under construction. It's mm-hmm. going up. Now Hollywood is the last piece.
Katie Swatowski covering all things Broward County for us at LRN. Thanks so much, Katie. Appreciate
Thanks,
it. Thanks for your reporting. Lots more to come here on the South Florida Roundup. We're going to shift gears, talk about some international politics and South Florida industry. Yeah, cruising to Cuba. The Trump administration this week announcing new travel restrictions for cruise lines that had been headed to Cuba after 3 years. Your thoughts, 800-743-9576, as the Roundup continues after this. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Cruise ships are no longer sailing between the United States and Cuba. The Trump administration ended the travel this week, 3 years after it began. The new restrictions aim to roll back efforts by the Obama administration to normalize relations with the communist island. The Trump administration has been targeting what it calls the Troika of Tyranny, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. That's the trio here. This is National Security Advisor John Bolton in Miami back in April.
I'm certain you would all agree that you do not improve relations with an imprisoned people by appeasing their captors. You improve relations with the oppressed by taking an unapologetic stand against their oppressors.
The Troika of Tyranny is what John Bolton has called it. Were you planning to travel and take a cruise to Cuba? Maybe you had passage already booked. What's the status? What have you heard from your cruise operator? Have you already been to Havana or elsewhere in Cuba by boat, either cruise line or your own vessel? What do you want to know about these travel restrictions, the impact here in the United States, certainly on South Florida, but also the impact on the island? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. That's our voice line. Of course, the text line is open as well here on the South Florida Roundup. Just let us know your name and where you're texting from. That text line is 786-786-7636. Again, the text line, 786-786-7636. Let's begin with Patrick Ottman, who covers Cuba for CNN. He's with us in Havana. Patrick, these new restrictions taking effect on Wednesday, a day after the announcement out of the Trump administration. What does the Port of Havana look like today?
Well, that's where I am. That's where our office is. And I can look out my window, and it's somewhat surreal because there are no cruise ships here. And this last 3 years, this is a very popular destination almost overnight for U.S. cruise companies. And I would look out and see two, sometimes three, a third ship waiting off the coast for one of those others to come out of the only two slips that they have in Havana. And the biggest problem they had here was there's not enough room for all the U.S. cruise ships. And it's not just that there aren't cruise ships here. The street between our office and the terminals is incredibly quiet because there used to be old cars parked there to take the people coming off the cruise ships on old car tours. They're charging about $40 an hour, which is more than a doctor makes in a month here. And there were guides waiting down to take people out. And there were a lot of restaurants that are private restaurants. They got a lot of business from cruise ship passengers. So in a day's time, that all went poof and has vanished. And I think many Cubans are very, you know, despite whether they support the government or not of their country, are very sad that that has happened because they certainly seek out connections with the U.S.
And Patrick, so what are you hearing from those Cubans that had been able to kind of find a business or service those cruise passengers that had been coming in on those boats that that originated from the United States?
They're just very disappointed. They think it's a step backwards. Even if they didn't benefit from the cruise ships, it was just something different here. And you would see families coming down in the port at night to just look at the cruise ships. And these, you know, Havana's not a very well-lit city at night, and these cruise ships, you know, have every light on. I used to receive their Wi-Fi signal over my office, so I missed that. They had huge TV screens, you know, pools you could see. It was like receiving visitors from the future. So I think, you know, people will miss that. And as well, it's not just cruise ships. It's, you know, people-to-people travel, which is a big category, the educational activities travel. That category is also going away. It was the most popular category for Americans to visit Cuba. And those people stayed in Airbnbs. They ate at restaurants. Yes, some of the money they spent in Cuba, of course, went into the government's pocket. It's pretty much impossible to spend money here and not have some of it go to the government and an economy that's so tightly controlled as Cuba's. But a lot of people did stay with Cuban hosts, and they sought out Cuban guides and ate at restaurants and really helped Cuban private entrepreneurs. And ever since the restrictions have started coming down, tourism is slowing down here, and people say that they're not making the money, private entrepreneurs, that they did just a couple years ago.
Following the money into government coffers in Cuba is important here. Patrick Ottman with CNN with us from Havana. Hold on, Patrick. Let me have Tim Padgett join our conversation now, who's covered Cuba for a great number of years, including the last several with us here at WLRN. This was the justification that the Trump administration gave when it essentially immediately canceled these licenses that allowed the U.S. cruise operators to send the ships into Port Havana and elsewhere, saying that they were paying dock fees, which were which was money that ultimately wound up in the government in Cuba.
Right. But the dock fee, most economic experts are telling us, the dock fee was really a relatively cheap means of simply pursuing the broader engagement with Cuba policy, which was getting Americans into the island, having contact with people there, and as Patrick was so rightly pointing out, spending a lot of money with private entrepreneurs who are really, according to the U.S. engagement policy, the people that we're trying to empower there to be to show that Cuban citizens can be more socially and economically independent of their rather stifling regime.
800-743-9576. Have you taken a cruise from Miami, from Port Everglades, maybe from the Gulf Coast of Florida? Perhaps it was from Port Canaveral. What was that cruise like? Is perhaps you cruised into Cuba over the last 3 years? Maybe you've got passage booked in the months ahead, but are curious as to what to happen now with the United States canceling the ability for U.S. cruise liners and private vessels, for that matter, to come into Port Havana and elsewhere. 800-743-9576. That's our voice line. 800-743-9576. You could also send us a text, 786-786-7636. Patrick Ottman with CNN, Tim Padgett with us here at WLRN, and you on the text line at 786-786-7636. What is, Tim, the ripple effect here in South Florida? Not in the cruise industry, but rather in the Cuban-American community, the exile community, that had been able to use these cruises as a means of travel, right, but also a means of engagement.
Right. A lot of Cuban-Americans, even older Cuban exiles, were using the cruise lines not only as a means to visit Cuba, but to go visit family. And they saw it. I think there was a little bit of nostalgia involved. Mm-hmm. But some of them also saw it as a way to visit Cuba without having, if they couldn't stay with a family member in their house, they could just stay on the cruise ship. There was some convenience involved. So it had become a very popular means of getting to Cuba, not just for Americans who wanted to smoke a cigar and drink some Havana Club, but also for Cuban Americans who have vested contacts there in terms of family and other means.
And Patrick, while the Treasury Department canceled these cruise licenses for American cruise ship companies, the airlines can still fly in to the airport in Havana and elsewhere directly from the United States. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. And that's an important point. Of course, they're going to presumably have less passengers. And we've seen the airlines just this year start flying smaller and smaller planes because less people are coming. Certainly people who are coming under the people category, there are less of those. And, you're talking to people, Americans, and they have some concern now about booking a trip. I mean, look at the people on the cruise ships the other day. You have people getting on a ship thinking they're coming to Cuba and ending up in Cozumel, Mexico, or cruise ships having to leave early. So at the end of the day, people want to take a vacation. They want to know they can take that vacation. And if the rules could change further, which is certainly an option, you could end up running the risk of having your vacation canceled. And just to Tim's point about Cuban Americans using the cruise ships, when the first cruises were announced, there was a whole backlash because the Cuban government didn't allow Cuban Americans, people born in Cuba, to come by ship. Right. And it wasn't until the U.S. cruise ships came out and said, we're going to cancel this,
right,
the Cuban government backed down, which was like the first time I can ever remember them doing that, and allowed Cuban Americans to come back on ships. So, the cruise travel wasn't perfect, but it was bringing about some welcome changes here.
So to both of you, right, the distinction that the administration appears to be making on cruise travel to Cuba, no. Airline travel to Cuba, okay.
Yeah. The big underlying problem here, I think, is that a lot of conservative, hardline Cuban exiles, including people like Florida Senator Marco Rubio, Mauricio Clavera Calderon, who heads Latin American policy at the National Security Council at the White House, they saw the cruise lines It was a symbolic thing, let's say. They saw the cruise ships going into Cuba as sort of a trivial, let's say, too lighthearted means of travel to Cuba. It was too touristy. It was too much of an insult, I think, symbolically, you know, again, to Cuban exiles who felt that, you know, they had that we were being too soft on Cuba. I think there's a visual difference there between a cruise line. You know, it's got that whole carnival atmosphere and everything. It's more of a vacation-y kind of, whereas, you know, if you're just flying it on an airplane, it looks a little more serious.
Patrick?
And as well, you know, you still can come down here if you're a Cuban-American visiting family. That has not changed. And they've got to come somehow. So that would be planes. Obviously, U.S. diplomats and diplomats from other countries use those flights, and people are coming for professional research and that kind of thing. But I agree with Tim's point. You know, it's if you're on a cruise ship, it's a vacation. And that's where the line blurred here, because at the end of the day, there's still a ban on tourism, and some Americans don't understand that hey, we're Americans, we're free, we can travel anywhere we want in the world. And the answer is to that is no. Cuba is one of those places, maybe the place that where you actually face the most restrictions as an American. And Cuban officials love to make the point to me that Cubans who get visas to the United States are free to go there and do whatever they want. Right. The government doesn't restrict them, whereas the American government does restrict Americans coming here.
Yeah, it's a clear distinction that is often made here in South Florida, is that the travel restrictions on Americans in Cuba are American travel restrictions on Americans, not travel restrictions on Americans by Cuba.
And constitutionally questionable at that.
Yeah, Isla Morada on line three, Mark in the Middle Keys. Go ahead, Mark, you're on the radio.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking the time to let me talk. When Cuba first opened up, I have a bike shop in the Keys, and we knew some families in the Keys that had a family in Havana, and we took some bicycles over there, and we started doing bike rides in and around Havana. And we were bringing, like, clothing and stuff for some of the churches. And we would pay the family as guides and translators and renting the house. And it was a great source of income for that family. And they were, you know, a private enterprise. So, you know, for the last almost 3.5 years, we have, you know, brought, you know, up to 10 people per trip. And then during that time, we were teaching some of the young men there with the family how to maintain bikes, how to rent them out to other people they wanted to. It was a great source of income for them. So I had to cancel our next trip because of the upcoming, because of the new sanctions. And, you know, to me, you know, it doesn't hurt me, but I feel for the family and the people there because they were, we were going there under the exact intent that we thought Americans should be going there, is to interact with the Cuban people, teach them, you know, like a business, and also, you know, to donate goods to the church. And we never stayed at any of those hotels or went into those restaurants we were allowed to go to. We always ate at the family's homes or stayed at the family's place.
Mark, when you were traveling, did you travel via air or water into Cuba?
Air.
And so for you canceling those trips, it's because of the prohibition now on the people-to-people travel category that was put in place by the Trump administration. Is that accurate?
That's correct.
Yeah. Mark, thanks for joining us from Isla Morada. Patrick Ottman, this travel categories was something that the Obama administration put into place when it liberalized the relationship and the engagement with Cuba. As the Trump administration has begun kind of carving out some of those, what has been the impact in terms of American tourists or American visitors in Havana and elsewhere that you've traveled?
Americans, by and large, like to follow the rules. And if you're going to book a vacation, you know, you don't have to. It's like reading stereo instructions to figure out if you can. And you can't promise anybody it's not all going to change. So, you know, I was interviewing someone who opened up a restaurant, spent 6 years here, a Cuban, opening a restaurant just a few blocks away from the cruise ship terminal, because they would get people who would walk and Americans and come have lunch. It was a great spot. And he told me that he had a chef that was coming down every couple months to give classes to him and his employees. It's just one of these, like your previous caller talked about, one of these amazing partnerships that sprung up organically. And the same story. The chef wrote him the other day and said, I'm going to have to cancel my next trip. I don't want to take the risk. I'm concerned there won't be flights. I'm concerned I'll lose my money on the hotel. I'm concerned that I could get into trouble. So even if there is still a bit of a gray area in some of these categories, Americans, by and large, feel that Cuba is being shut down. And that's certainly the message that's coming out of the Trump administration, that you shouldn't go to Cuba, that if you support if you go to Cuba, you're supporting the Cuban government, which supports the Maduro regime in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And it's now we're back to sort of this Cold War atmosphere of we need to strangle Cuba. But unfortunately, that affects the people on the street and the entrepreneurs a lot more than it does the leadership here. I don't think anybody can realistically expect that, because there's no cruise ships coming into Havana anymore, that someone in the upper echelons of the Cuban leadership is going to go hungry tonight.
June in Delray Beach on line two. You've been patient. Go ahead, June. You're on the radio.
Hi. I think it's worse than this. This is like a rosy scenario. I think a lot of it is Donald Trump visiting Cuba, what, in 89? Or I can't remember the year, but he brought $68,000 down there. It was illegal, by the way, for him to do that at the time, but nobody brings that up. I think a lot of this is vindictiveness, that they didn't want him. And they didn't make a deal. I've spent a little bit of time on the island. I have I call him our adopted Cuban son, lives with me. You know, I've spent time with his family down there. What's going on now is, it's so cruel. I mean, it's just cruel. It's like, kids in cages. They have no clue what they're doing. They don't care.
June, we get it. Let me ask Patrick, who is reporting on the streets in Havana and elsewhere, about the current conditions. The euphemism of another special period has been bandied about in terms of the lack of access to fuel, to cooking fuel, to food, and to jobs as well. So, Patrick, when you see the administration tightening kind of the regulations regarding the interaction between the United States and Cuba at a time with the Cuban economy already in a spiral, what are the current conditions like, and where could they be headed?
And a lot of that is to be blamed on the Cuban government's mismanagement of the economy. Mm-hmm. The fact they still have not wanted to open up completely and let their people really achieve what we all know Cubans can. But in the 7 years that I've been living here, I've never seen the economy this bad. You have hour-long waits for everything now. The government is rationing products that were plentiful just a few years ago. And there's a sense of desperation that, what you talk about with the special period, going back to that really dark period right after the Soviet Union fell, and people were hungry, and there was nothing to buy. And that people, of course, fled in rafts by the thousands to South Florida.
Yeah, well, I think a big difference.
Nobody wants to repeat that.
Yeah, and a big difference this time around is, the wet foot, dry foot policy, which was instituted after that period in the mid 90s, I believe it was. Tim, correct me if I'm wrong.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That policy has been prohibited now.
It is no longer the case.
It's not as easy for Cubans escaping the island to get into the United States now. And so what we're seeing is a push now for these Cuban migrants to go through Central America and up through Mexico to the U.S. border. So we're seeing Cubans now become migrants just in the same vein as Central Americans. And
which is adding to the pressure along that border with Mexico.
Exactly. So, I mean, you've got the Trump administration sort of, playing the get tough act with Cuba on one end, but then exacerbating what it calls the crisis on the border on the other end.
Yeah. What about the role of Venezuela in all of this as it relates specifically to the Trump administration policy into Cuba? John Bolton has talked about Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. Senator Rubio and others have pointed to the influence of Cuba with the Maduro regime, and how some estimate that Cuba is continuing to prop up Maduro and allowing him somehow to be in power.
This policy has both a foreign and a domestic component to it. The domestic component, as we all know, is that Trump feels that the hardline Cuban exiles here helped him win Florida in 2016, and he hopes that they'll do that for him again in 2020. The foreign policy component is that they think that this is the moment. This is the moment with Venezuela collapsing and not being able to subsidize Cuba with oil, et cetera, anymore, that this is the moment when the Cuban regime is vulnerable. And if we just keep squeezing, this will be the time that we'll see regime change in Cuba. Problem is, I mean, you mentioned, you know, I've been covering Cuba now for more than 30 years, and I remember the same rhetoric in the 1990s. If this is the moment now that Russia and the Soviet Union have finally collapsed,
right.
If we just squeeze now, but it didn't happen. And there are a lot of experts who will tell you it's not likely to happen now. And in fact, a lot of experts will tell you this is actually hurting the cause of regime change in Cuba, because it's just going to galvanize and energize those the communist hardline dinosaurs inside Cuba. And I think Patrick would probably agree with me on that.
Are you experiencing that, Patrick?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just watching on the Cuban National Daily News broadcast, you know, the new president of Cuba sounds like the previous president of Cuba, previous leaders of Cuba, and talking about how everything is to blame, all the problems, the shortages I described, on the fact that America is tightening up the embargo further. So that's always been the excuse. It'll always be the excuse, and I think a lot of people fault the United States for giving Cuba the excuse. And you wonder if the day the embargo is lifted, you know, how much really will change. You know, we won't know until that actually happens. But in the meantime, it's a very convenient excuse for the Cuban government to say, oh, look, it's because they're tightening up financial sanctions, they're making it tougher to visit, there's no more cruise ships. That's why there's not chicken in the market. And, of course, it's much more complicated than that.
Patrick Oppmann with CNN, the offices of CNN near a quiet port of Havana here today with no U.S. cruise ships that prohibited earlier this week. Patrick, always great to have you on the program. Thanks for your reporting today.
Thank you.
Tim Padgett, our Latin America correspondent and editor with us here at WLRN. Timothy, thanks for your perspective as well.
Thank you, as always, Tom.
Program is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director here at WLRN. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Mertz. The director of radio programming and our technical supervisor is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and listening. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man.